You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts, Jim and Bobby Bell, for tonight.
And thank you for joining us once again. That, of course, was the Hot Texas Swing Band with a little bit of Hot Texas to kick off the show. And Jim, who's our guest tonight?
Our guest tonight, Chris Enns.
Yeah, she's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. We're so excited to have her with us. And let's see, next weekend, can you believe it already? Next weekend.
Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival.
Yes.
With the Buckaroo Bookshop.
We're very excited to be back after a three-year hiatus. Yeah. If you're in the Los Angeles area, you will want to come on out to Santa Clarita. And very briefly tonight, this is our last opportunity to share with you a little bit about what's going on. We're going to talk about the special programming that we are partnering with the Friends of the Santa Clarita Library up at their beautiful Old Town New Hall Library in the community room. We'll have live programs both days, but this is Sunday now that we're talking about April 23rd. And yeah, our first, who's going to be kicking off the, who's going to be kicking off that event?
We have Andrea Kidd.
Yeah, let's see. I'm going to hold it up a little higher. So Andrea Kidd is a cowgirl poet and a world-known equestrian. And she is going to be, these are her CDs, Sespe Sky and Sespe Lullaby. She's going to be kicking off the activity in the library at 11 o'clock. Andrea Kidd, cowgirl poet, Where the Spirit of the West Rhymes On. It's a one-woman presentation about cowgirl poetry, and she's just a kick. You'll really enjoy her. And then at 12 o'clock, we have Wayne Purcell. With his Justice for All, the Search for Big Poker Tom. Now, he's going to have a PowerPoint presentation and talk about the research and what he did to that all ends up in this fabulous book, which just became a 2023 Spur finalist award winner. And we're so excited. Wayne can't wait to come and join us. And that's at 12 o'clock. And then at 1 o'clock, we have our panel discussion for the day. The panel is titled New Westerns and Their Future. And our good friend Courtney Joyner is moderating the panel. Although we park maybe here as well. This is one of Courtney's many books. This is
We have this one here, The Violent Times.
The Shotgun Western series. And along with Courtney on the panel, we have writers J.R. Sanders. And this is one of his books, the first of the Nate Ross mystery series. Book three is coming out at the end of the month. We have Bruce Civilly with us. He's joining us for a first time with his book, The Last Stage, which is a fictional account, kind of how Wyatt Earp imagined his last days of life would be. And our good friend, Bill Wilbur, who was with us back in 2009 when we started the bookshop and a couple of other times with his book, Saragossa. And he is the third person on the panel. Following the panel, not quite yet, following the panel, is Peter Schirico. Oh, my gosh. Peter Schirico is larger than life, larger than the West, and you've got to come and meet him. He will be doing a one-man presentation from novel to script and from script to movies. And there isn't anything like Peter to talk about the myth and reality of the West and the West on screen. And then the programs will end at 3 o'clock with the final presentation by new writer E. Joe Brown, our good friend Joe. And his book is the first of a saga series. He's working on book two right now. This is A Cowboy's Destiny, the Kelly Can series saga. And Joe is going to be not only talking about the book, but also performing music and that goes along with the book. And the book is loosely based on his great-grandfather. And so he'll also be talking about the research that he did and how this book came to be. And that's all April 23rd at the Buckaroo Bookshop, up away from the bookshop and up at the Old Town New Hall Library. If you want to know more about this event, Jim, where do they go?
They go to cowboyfestival.org. That's www.cowboyfestival.org.
Yes.
You'll get all the information you need.
You'll see all the headliners, the music, and there's even going to be
there's some great performers.
Peach Cobbler.
Are you kidding? Peach Cobbler.
Cobbler and stay for the music and the books. On our Facebook page, Rendezvous with a Writer Out West, I have been posting almost a daily countdown, highlighting the authors and the events, and that will continue right through to next weekend. So thank you for letting us take a moment to talk about this event that's so fun and is taking up a lot of our energy and passion right now. So, changing gears, who's our guest tonight?
Chris Enns.
Chris Enns, and she's joining us right now. Here she is. Hi, Chris.
Well, hello. Thank you so much for having me be a part of the program. I was so excited when you were talking about who your guests will be at the fair, and Courtney Joyner is just a fabulous writer, and gosh, he just knows everything that there is to know about motion pictures. He's just a walking encyclopedia.
Yeah, he is.
And he's so funny and he's so nice. And J.R. Sanders is, he's brilliant. J.R.
Yes.
Sanders is brilliant. And I know that you have talked with one of my other favorite people all the time, Jim Jones.
Oh, yes. Brilliant. We're having dinner with him tomorrow night.
Is he just the greatest guy or what? He's just wonderful.
Yeah, and he's in the middle of a recording project right now. We're excited to hear more about that tomorrow night with Jim. But yeah, I don't know. Some of you, you're all able to just multitask and you're involved in so many different things. You write across different genres. Some of you even private detectives in your spare time, you know? I don't know how you all get it.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what makes somebody like Jim Jones so fascinating. I'm just kind of a one-note gal. I just write nonfiction. But Jim Jones, I mean, he's music, he does books, he's just an all-around talent.
Yeah. Well, Jim has a little something to say about you, so I'm going to let him go ahead and officially introduce you.
This is just a formal little bio here. Chris Enns is a New York Times bestselling author, a scriptwriter, and comedian who has written for television and film and performed on cruise ships and on stage. She has worked with award-winning musicians, writers, directors, producers, and as a screenwriter for Tricor Entertainment. But her passion is for telling the stories of men and women who shaped the history and mythology of the American West. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're talking tonight about two of her books, The Widowed Ones, Remembering Beyond the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which we will talk about in just a moment. And then the other book, it was fun because there were two books, so we each picked one to read. And then her second book, which we'll be talking about in shortly, is Straight Lady, The Life and Times of Margaret Dumont, the Fifth Marx Brothers. So two books that are quite different from one another, but engaging, wonderfully written, page turning, so insightful and so well researched and full of all kinds of interesting things. So,
well, I'm glad they were a bookend because, you know, with the Widowed Ones, it's very heavy and there's a lot of drama and a lot of sadness. And then you go from that to the laughter with the Marx Brothers. Yeah. So.
Well, we'll start. We're going to start talking about this one, which is so near and dear to my heart. And as I shared with you the other day, there was a period in both of our lives. We were just really so interested in everything having to do with the Battle of the Little Bighorn, all of the events and years that led up to it. We went to a history conference and walked the battlefield. met a lot of the authors that we had written. We'd read books and read to be prepared for that. And all I kept thinking as the more that I got into it was, but what about the women? But right. What about the wives and the widows and the children? And, you know, as you know, in the books, you get some of it. It's in the story. You can't, you know, deny it. But thank you, Chris, for telling their story. It's a story that I have wanted to know for a long time. So thank you for this book.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I was so pleased to be able to work with a lot of Elizabeth Custer's original material, which if you can see on the front of the book, Chris Courtlander is one of the people that we credit. Howard Kazanjian and I have written quite a few books together. And this one was because of Chris Courtlander, we were able to do a lot of the writing that we did because Chris has all of Elizabeth's things. So it's wonderful to be able to dive into Elizabeth's things and to be able to tell the story from her point of view and from the other widows. I was able to talk with Susie Yates, who was Annie Yates's granddaughter.
Oh my.
And the granddaughter, Susie Yates, her godmother was Libby Custer. So she had some amazing stories to tell about Libby and about her grandmother. And so, you know, being able to put your hands into this original history and it not be filtered through anything else, and you can just write it as they tell you. So it was exciting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how does the word come to Elizabeth, to Libby, and then what does she do when she gets the word?
Well, oftentimes when the men were in the field and they were engaged in whatever skirmish or battle that they were engaged in, there would be rumors that maybe that they were killed, or everybody wiped out. And George would always tell Elizabeth, don't listen to any of that. You wait until you have official word. And certainly when the ladies were at Fort Lincoln and they had heard what was going on at the Little Bighorn, they heard rumors. They didn't really know for sure what was happening. And so they couldn't sleep. Libby and her niece was there and a good friend was there. Her sister-in-law, Margaret Calhoun, who was also a really good friend, they were all with Libby the night that the news came. And they're waiting and it's hot and they can't sleep. And finally they hear the heavy footsteps of the commanding officer coming to tell them, or the officer in charge coming to tell them the three sentences that broke Libby's heart, which was none wounded, none missing, all dead.
Yeah.
So in that time she knows, and she was incredibly brave. She holds herself together and insists that she go and tell all the other widows what has happened. She didn't think that was proper, as her husband was the commander of that particular post. Mm. She didn't think it was proper that the news just came from one of the other officers who let her officially know what's going on. And so here she is, having her heart just broken, going around to each one of the widows and letting them know personally what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, let me ask a question. How long a time span was it from the time the battle ended to the ladies found out?
Oh, I don't think that it was maybe 6 hours, maybe 7 hours. Okay. It wasn't that long.
It's pretty current then.
Yeah, it was pretty soon that they learned. You know, I mean, they were waiting. They had rumors of it. So they were waiting to really get the official verification that happened. But they didn't know specifically what happened. And for the seven officers' wives, six of them were at Fort Lincoln. Grace Harrington was at Fort Rice.
Right.
And so for the six widows that were there, and then later Grace Harrington came over and joined them. For those seven officers' wives, they longed to know exactly what happened. And that was the very difficult because it was horrific and no one wanted to tell them specifically what happened. Some of the men, they were beheaded. Mm. Some of the men's bodies were burned beyond recognition. And the only thing that they could tell who these particular men were from buttons or journals that were on their person. And those particular, that's what I found fascinating when I was writing the book, how the wives would always find a particular thing to sew onto their husband's garments. So in case something happened, they would be able to recognize them. So oftentimes they got them special buttons and they sewed the buttons on their garments. And so for a couple of these women, that's how they found out what had happened. Donald McIntosh had a journal that they found. And so that's how Molly learned what happened. But really the book is not, the book is about the women. The book is about what happened to them because we think the press is bad today in being intrusive into people's sadness and their grief. Nothing compared to what was going on in 1870, when this particular battle occurred, and how these women were dogged by the press. You know, what happened? Where are you going to go? How are you going to live? What's going to happen with your children? What do you know that happened at the battle? And they didn't know anything that happened at the battle.
Right.
They weren't in on any of the particulars that were. I don't even think any of the seventh were really in it. They were caught completely unaware. So nobody had any clear idea of what happened. So anyone thinking about picking up this book and thinking that they're going to find some sort of statement about what happened in the battle are going to be disappointed because this was strictly about how the women found out and what they did with their lives afterwards. And how they dealt with the press. As I was saying, 3 days after George is killed at the battle, Custer is killed at the battle. The press is at his mother and father's home, wanting to, you know, and they were grieving because they had lost 3 sons. They had lost.
Press hasn't changed.
They were devastated. And so to have the press show up saying, so was he, you know, did George know, was he really that arrogant? Tell us what he was thinking. You know, I mean, can you absolutely imagine whatever you feel about Custer is immaterial. This was a family that was grieving and to be so bold as to intrude and then be quite rude about it. I was moved by Margaret Calhoun. That's another book. Margaret Calhoun, who was George's sister. You know, she lost her husband. She lost 3 brothers. She lost a nephew. She was devastated.
Amazing.
I mean, if you read in the book how difficult she was ill for a lot of the time afterwards and really lost her ability to speak correctly. She had to work on that. And then, oddly enough, later on in life, becomes an elocutionist and goes and recites poetry. I mean, that's how she earns a living. She goes to these different events, recites poetry, reads from different books. And that was quite a leap that she had to take from being just so incredibly broken. But, you know, Elizabeth was broken too. Both Maggie and Elizabeth go back to George's family and live with his mother and his father and stepmother. And Elizabeth just transforms that room to look like everything was decorated with George's things, his desk, his pictures. And she just stayed in there for days and days and days. Other women like Annie Yates she had children. So she really didn't have the opportunity to spend a whole lot of time just focusing on that. She had to pick herself up. She had children. My kids have to eat. I have to be able to get them in school. I have to get this thing going. Each one of them dealt with their grief in a different way.
It was interesting. You talked about how many letters, bereavement letters, like mm-hmm. Elizabeth would receive. They all did. And there were also efforts to raise money to provide some additional monies for them. But the bereavement and the cultural, the way that bereavement was handled at that time, I thought was very interesting. The letters, you want to just mention a little bit about letters of condolence and bereavement?
Well, I found it fascinating when I was going through Elizabeth's letters that all of these bereavement letters and cards had a black tape border around them. And I thought, you know, that's just very strange. But that's how they did things at that particular time period in history. That's how you expressed your grief and how sad you were over that particular loss of that person was dictated how thick that tape was going to be around the border of those, the outside of the envelopes and the outside of the card or letter itself.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, who knew? I mean, now we just, you know, we run out to a grocery store and pick up a condolence card and hope that the sentiment on the front matches what we feel in our heart. At that particular time, you had to make a statement in other ways to show, not just in writing, how sorry you were, but I just find that those kind of truths about the history fascinating.
Yeah. What was there anything else that in your research really surprised you that, you know, you just hadn't expected to have that come to light or, you know?
For me, it was the prolonged grief that these ladies had to endure because not all of the bodies were moved at the same time. They were moved at different times and then placed in different areas. And so it wasn't actually until it was a year later that they really had everything assembled that they could have an opportunity to grieve in one unit because things were just in constant motion. Yeah. So you couldn't even really get to a point where your grief ended for a little while and you could take a breath. Mm. This was just, it went on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And just trying to be able to make it. What I found fascinating too was, you know, they're in Fort Lincoln. These widows are at Fort Lincoln and they are told not too long after the battle, okay, ladies, thank you very much. You're going to have to go. We have other troops coming in with their families. So you'll have to just put your things together and go. I know you're sad, but thank you very much. This is what army life is like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you read in the book how Elizabeth and the other widows are going through their things and things that they know they can't take with them, they take to the camp mercantile. And so they have those items there for other women who are coming in to be able to purchase.
Yeah.
Or be able to just to be given.
Yeah.
And then when Elizabeth does say goodbye, she has a card, a studio card with George's face on it. And so she calls everybody together and then standing on the steps of their quarters, bids everybody goodbye. And then everyone gets a signed card of with Custer's picture on it. So they will always remember what has happened at that particular time period.
Yeah. I thought part of that story, the kind of life at the, you know, life at Fort Lincoln before, and wonderful pictures in this book and gatherings and picnics and, you know, out here we are on the steps leading up to the building and really a lot of it's life at the fort. It's military life. And then as you're describing now, you it's so their lives are just so changed. They don't have that camaraderie anymore. They don't have that support system anymore. And as you say, many go back home because they don't have a lot of choices and they go home to aging parents and they become caretakers.
Right.
You know, here they are in their 30s. Elizabeth's what, 34? And right. You know, they're young women and they're just their lives, as so often happens as widows, it's just turned totally upside down.
Right. And where are you going to get a work? Where, you know, I mean, this is the mid 1870s. Where are you get, you know, as a widow, a woman who's, you know, trying to find work, where, you know, the options are very limited at that time period, but, and you have children. So you've really got to, of course, Libby didn't have children and neither did Margaret Calhoun, but, they still had to be able to find a way to make a living. Mm-hmm. You know, they, all of the widows didn't get a whole lot. I mean, if you read in the book, I thought that was fascinating too. And then I list what each one of them got after what was coming to them and how gracious it was for the Army Navy Journal to be able to have this fundraiser. So, mm-hmm. so people could contribute to these women who had families and to be able to go on. Mm-hmm. And they got a certain amount of money, and then each one of the children got a certain amount of money. But I mean, I think it amounted to like $8.
For I know, it was.
It wasn't a whole lot.
It wasn't a whole lot. Yeah. Well, we've been talking about the widowed ones. I'm going to hold it up again. Beyond the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And it was just a riveting read. I really enjoyed it. I did have to read it fairly quickly because for this show, we read a book a week. And I would have liked to have had a few days. I would like to have been able to read a chapter and think about that part of the story and sort of put it down and have a glass of wine or something, you know,
and pick it back up again. After you read a chapter of that book, you need to have a drink of wine. It's really heavy. I mean, it's very sad when they're on the train traveling and they're just broken and they're leaving Fort Lincoln and they're on the train and the press is following them. And Libby holds it together until she reaches her in-laws home and just completely breaks down.
Yeah. Well, and It is a somber book, but readers out there, don't be put off by that because it's a fabulous book. And I would really encourage you to get into the lives of these seven women and see how they kind of deal with situation, a very, you know, tragic situation, but they deal with it and they move forward. And I think we can all take a lesson from that too, right?
And you know, at the heart of it, it's a story of friendship.
Yes.
It's a story of bonding with your girlfriends over a shared tragedy that no one else is going to be able to understand.
Yeah.
You know, I said that there were seven widows, but the one widow, Grace Harrington, had the worst time of all because her husband was the only one listed as missing in action at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And when she returns home, not too long after she gets home, she's having dreams that her husband, Henry, is still alive and calling her and saying, please come and get me. Please, I need you to come and find me. Mm-hmm. And she collapses and eventually leaves her home and her children to go looking for him and is missing for 3 years. No mm-hmm. one knows where she's mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. No one knows what's happened to her.
Yeah, I couldn't help but think that there was a TV series in her story.
Well, I am doing another book. I'm doing a book just about Grace.
Are you? Are you? Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break and let our listeners find out where they can find your book along with all of the other books of our authors. And when we come back, we'll be changing gears and we'll be talking about Straight Lady. Stay with us. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writers with our special guest, Chris Enns. And we're going to be talking about Margaret Dumont, who worked with the Marx Brothers.
Straight lady.
Yeah. She
Yeah. So go it, go it, go right at it, Jim. I know you've got lots of things you want to bring up.
You know, what inspired this book?
I have been a Margaret Dumont fan ever since I've watched my first Marx Brothers movie. I think that the people in comedy that are the straight person really don't ever get their the recognition they deserve. But I thought that Margaret Dumont's response to all of the shenanigans that the Marx Brothers did, and her play with Groucho was extraordinary. So I just had to write about her.
Well, that's good. He's a tough guy, you know. You have to have some moxie to stand up to him. So
yeah.
You know, she had a real career before she ever met these guys.
I know. That's what's so fascinating about doing the book about Maggie. You know, she was an incredibly gifted songstress. She was an amazing soprano, had an amazing soprano voice. Her mother was a music teacher and really trained her musically and helped her voice, helped shape who she was, really gave her that confidence to go on stage. And she's very young when she is on stage. And you see the pictures in there, Jim. You know, she's absolutely stunning when she's just a young gal.
Yes,
we forget when we look at her as she is in the Marx Brothers films that she really, you know, she had a life before that, and she was really quite striking and had a wonderful presence on Broadway stage, and had such an amazing voice. I thought this was interesting that George and Cohan wrote music for her.
Yes, he did.
He was crazy about her. And she is also recognized on Broadway for her comedic timing. And I wanted to bring that up because Groucho always said she never got any of our jokes. But that was just not true. Margaret would be the first one to tell you, I get the jokes. My job is to be a straight person. Right. And so I will be a straight person. And I will be the best at it. And she was.
She was. How did she meet the guys? How did they get together?
Well, they had been working on Broadway and on vaudeville for a while, right. And a screenwriter had an idea for a program for them called The Coconuts, which is really based on a lot of the skits that they were already doing on vaudeville. And so, really, when you see The Coconuts, what's lacking is really a cohesive story. The story was like, you know, you talk about your key, the log line for your show is story is what matters. You know, it didn't matter for the Marx Brothers. Sideline, you know, we'll work on story later. You know, they had different bits that they did on stage that worked. So being able to come up with something to put it all together. And George Kaufman was one of the very first who worked with the boys. And so when he's putting together the Coconuts, they're trying to find a star that could play the dowager in Coconuts and in the Coconuts. And Kaufman had already seen Margaret on stage, and he's the one that said, you know, we got to get Dumont in here. Now Dumont was very well known. She was much more well known than the Marx Brothers at the time.
He was.
When the Marx Brothers are told Margaret Dumont's going to be in this, they are really excited. They think, wait a second, Margaret Dumont is fantastic for us. So that starts it off. And it's such a chemistry with her and Groucho and the rest of them that it's undeniable. And so that's where it launched. And, you know, they spent a great deal of time, not only before any film was even shot, they would go and workshop these particular comedy bits with Margaret in front of a live audience just to see what would work. And Margaret was the true north for the boys, because if they got a laugh, they would milk that laugh and they would leave the script. And Margaret would be the one that would have to pull them back. Oh, okay. Well, you're really, you know, here's where we're at and here's where you need to be. But Margaret was that person. And but, uh, she was really, they would look to her. And once in a while when she might get lost, because they were quite physical with her in the, I mean, they would jump on her. They would trip her. If she ever lost a line, and when she would say cue, either Chico or Harpo, or sometimes Groucho, would come out with a pull cue.
Oh.
Hit her with the pool cue.
Oh my God.
And they would do it because the audience
would
laugh.
So you mentioned that she had a padded corset eventually to.
Eventually she did, because they were just brutal to her, and she had cracked ribs and she was sore a lot. And so, you know, whenever you see her, you think, wow, she really is quite stocky. Well, she was quite stocky because she's wearing garments underneath to keep from being bruised.
Oh my goodness. So,
you know, and they were, she loved them very much. And she would always say, you know, they were kind of like her brothers, and they recognized her as the fifth Marx brother. But they were quite, they played practical jokes on her that went too far. One of the jokes that I talk about in the book that they did was, they're traveling, and I believe they're in Chicago when this is happening. I can't remember exactly where, but they're in Chicago and they're in a hotel. So they would go and they would do their show and they would come back to the hotel at night. And Margaret had gone out to eat with some friends and come back to the hotel on her own. And when she got to the hotel, the night guard was there, or the security guard was there waiting, or the house detective, I should say, that's what they had at those time, house detectives. So the house detective was waiting with the police. And when she came in, they said, Miss Dumont, we need to speak with you about the fact that you are running a prostitution ring out of your hotel room. And she said, she was just amazed. What are you talking about? I would never do anything like that. And they said, well, we need to go up into your room and check it out. So they walk with her to her room. The whole time she's saying, this is a huge mistake. Nothing like that ever went. So when they get to the room, she is trying to put her key in the door. And as she's putting her key in the door, Chico walks by and says, oh, I didn't know you had other people. I'll come back in a half an hour. and then she walks into the door, and Groucho was there with his own. Well, okay, I guess I'll come back later too. And then Zippo comes out and says, just because I'm the youngest doesn't mean that I can't be treated with the same respect as the other boys. I'll pay.
Oh.
And so it's just looking worse and worse. And then the last to come out was Harpo, who was in the tub wearing nothing but a tie and his wig. And he comes out completely naked. And out of the bathroom, well, not completely naked, he's wearing a wig and his hat and a tie. And so it looks very bad for her. So the house detective and the police say, you have to leave. You can't stay here. And so she's in tears and having to pack up and leave. And, you know, it's all fun and games for them. But this really was, she was quite hurt by that. And they would come and find her afterwards, because she went back to she had no place else to go but to the train station to wait for the train to leave the next morning for their next show. And they catch up with her and they apologize. And she always took him back. But it was exhausting to the fifth Marx Brothers.
Yeah, it would have been. Oh. Did you see all the movies? Did you?
Oh, many, many, many times. And that's what I loved being able to write about the book, because you know, Jim, here's what's so sad. Jim and Bobby, I had to watch all the movies again. It was for research. So.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I saw several of them, but it's been so long ago that I can't remember.
Well, you need to reacquaint yourself with them, because I tell you, A Day at the Races is my favorite. And Margaret Dumont wins a Golden Globe for her work on The Day at the Races. So, she's pretty amazing. We forget about how good she was. I mean, if you win a Globe, you're not a slouch. You're pretty good at what you do.
Yeah. You are.
Yeah.
Now, was there life after the Marx Brothers? I assume there was for Margaret.
Well, she did work pretty steady, but the work that she did was very much like the work that she had always done, with the exception of a couple of roles. She did a film with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans where she plays dual characters. But everybody in that film plays dual characters. But she really is quite talented. So, you know, she's kind of stereotyped, but golly, if I'm known for the rest of my life in the seven films that she does with the Marx Brothers, it's been a good life.
Didn't she meet a lot of other people like Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Bob
Hope? She did. She was in quite a few films. She did a film with Shirley MacLaine. She did a lot of work with W.C. Fields. When we take that for granted too. Yeah. So, you know, she was really trained in, she worked with the best comedians in the business. Yeah. So yeah, she did go on and work with some heavy hitters after that. But, you know, as I said, it wasn't as though she was going from the Marx Brothers to doing Sophie's Choice, you know.
She was always
the same kind of very proper, very dignified lady about town.
Was this a quote of hers or yours? I can't remember, but I wrote it down. Living is easy and comedy is hard. Who said that?
That was Groucho Marx.
That was Groucho Marx. Okay.
Yeah. And it's Groucho Marx said it, but I mean, it originated somewhere else. But Marx always said it. You know, one of the things I always thought was amazing when they're doing their shows, how, and I write about this in the book, how they had to keep changing the jokes because the radio stars would, or radio producers would come to the shows and hear it. And then the next day, all the Marx Brothers jokes they did on stage would be on the radio.
So I
thought that was fascinating when I was researching.
I remember that. That's right.
How often they got ripped off.
Yeah.
And,
quite often.
You know, Margaret was always game for anything. If you watch, and that's why you guys need to go back and watch the movies to see just how much abuse she took, because she did take a lot of it. You know, at one time, she was married once to a gentleman by the name of Moeller, and his family had a sugar business in upstate New York. It's incredibly wealthy, but her husband was a very wealthy golf pro. Amateur golfer. And so he's quite a bit older than she was, but they had a very happy life together. And she gave up the stage to be with John, her husband. And you know, who knew that when she came back, she would come back with the force as she did. She had this amazing career before she married, and then this amazing career afterwards. And a lot of people don't get to have two careers.
No,
that's true.
So this is, it's a testament to how talented she was. And even Groucho, he finally recognizes her when he receives an honorary Academy Award in 1979. He does thank her for her contribution, and he does say, "I wish Margaret were here."
So I'm looking at the time there, Chris. I can't believe how fast it's gone. So what are you working on next?
Well, I just had, I opened the box up today and my new book was here. It's called An Open Secret. The history of the notorious bordellos in Deadwood. And what makes that particular, it's not your run-of-the-mill story about soiled doves, Bobby Jean, if you're thinking that. I'll tell you right
Actually, I'm not. I know it's going to...
prostitution started in Deadwood in 1876, and it didn't stop being a main source of business in that town until 1980. So it was 103 years of prostitution. And that's what makes this particular story about Deadwood, you know, quite remarkable.
Yeah.
That prostitution was around that long.
Yeah. And I know you have a book launch planned coming up. It's on your website.
Yes.
And what's the date on that?
That's June 16th and 17th. I will be doing a lawn program outside at the Adams Museum. And then here's something that not a lot of people can say and hold their head up high. On the 17th, I'll be at the Brothel Museum. I can legitimately say, you'll find me at the brothel in Deadwood.
Yeah, yeah. You have a great website, and you often are doing book giveaways and such. Let's make sure our listeners know how to find you online. Where do they go?
Well, thank you. It is chrisentss.com, and it's chrisentss.com. And I do a book giveaway every month. And this month, the book giveaway is in commemoration for Mother's Day next month. And it's a book that I wrote called Ma Barker, America's Most Wanted Mother. So not only do you get an opportunity to win a copy of the book about the notorious Ma Barker, but you also get an opportunity to win a Kindle, new Kindle.
You do amazing research. All of your books are so well researched. Do you have a tip for, let's say, somebody that is working in nonfiction? Any kind of a great tip to help them research, you know, get to an archive they wouldn't have thought of, or just anything that comes to mind?
Well, here's something that people forget to do. Not everything is spelled correctly. Let's say that you go into an archives department and you go into the computer and you're looking at something from long ago, or you're searching through the records and misspell a word. Like if you're doing any research about in the Tucson, Arizona area, misspell Tucson. You'll be absolutely amazed how many things that will come up because you've misspelled a word.
That's brilliant. Mm. Yeah.
And people don't often think about that. If you misspell something, you're going to get a lot more hits, which sounds preposterous because why would you purposely misspell things? But names have been misspelled. You know, a lot when I was doing doing the Ma Barker research, when I went to do, I spent a lot of time at the National Archives going over that, Hoover has a lot of his writings about Ma Barker, which is where I got some of this. But again, the name is not always spelled correctly. Sometimes it's spelled Baker. So you have to go.
That's a great tip. Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you being with us tonight, Chris. Thank you so very, very much. Don't go away. But we are going to now kind of wrap the show as we have our countdown almost happening. So once again, we've been talking about Straight Lady and The Widowed Ones, Chris Entss, and we've just been delighted to have you with us.
It's been fun.
Thank you guys so much.
Next week, in honor of April being National Poetry Month, and we will be, of course, at a festival. So a good friend of ours, award-winning poet Tom Swearingen, he was with us last December as a guest host. He's coming back, and this is his CD and his book, and he will be here with another award-winning poet, Miska Paget, who is absolutely delightful. This is her CD, and she's working on a children's book at the moment, and they are going to have a great time, and so will you. They will share poetry. They'll talk about what inspires them to write and how they write and rhythm and rhyme and all that fun. We'll be here next week, a week from today. And then we're back 2 weeks from today. And our guest the following week, the memoir, and we're looking forward to that. And then April will be into May. Mm-hmm. And our first guest, the first week of May, our first Johnny Bones. And we will talk more about that when we're here again in 2 weeks. Jim, do you have a quote for tonight?
Quotes, we do have. We have two quotes. One, of course, is from Margaret Dumont. I'm a straight lady, the best in Hollywood. There is an art to playing the straight role. You must build up your man, but never top him. Never steal the laughs.
So true.
And from George Kaufman. I didn't like the play, but then I saw it under adverse conditions. The curtain was up.
Oh, that Kaufman. He was amazing.
He was funny.
He was very funny. Very funny.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing this 50 minutes with us.
Such a good time. Such a good time. Thank you.
Thank you.
So,
To wrap up, remember, it's always a great day
out west. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.